Good afternoon. It's hard to compete with eating lunch in New Orleans, that's for sure. But I am happy to see your faces here and certainly willing to share our experiences in Louisiana. This is turning out to be quite a meeting, so definitely welcome to all of you that are new to New Orleans and visiting first time, and certainly hope you get to enjoy some of the culture that while you're here and want to come back. We certainly enjoy having visitors, and we managed to get a lot of visitors for this meeting, so it's been fun to be a part of that and watch it. My talk today is going to talk about emergency preparedness and medical response, but trying to bring in perspective, how does public health work in a response arena, and how public health has transitioned to do this, and in Louisiana certainly has done so in a tremendous way. I'm going to see if I can make this move. Okay. So I'm going to provide a brief overview of Louisiana's emergency operations plan. We'll talk about the range of operational plans and expertise. We'll demonstrate somewhat the HR timeline, which anybody from Louisiana knows that's when the tropical storm winds hit the coast. And we'll provide considerations on improving response plans based on sharing our plan. To tell you the truth, it would have been nice to have more people here from the standpoint of sharing our experiences, because what we saw in Sandy is that people had to repeat the same mistakes. That what we learned in Katrina and Rita, Gustav and Ike, and just a number of storms, we saw the same errors repeated again in their response. So there is not a lot of sharing of this information that translates into transforming our approach to preparedness when you talk about other areas of the country. And that, to me, is a shame that we have to repeat our errors to learn from our errors, but it seems to be human nature. As you know, there are a lot of emergency support functions in government. This truly is something we focused on as a result of Katrina, but it really started approaching using emergency support functions after we started dealing with 9/11 and the funding that came down to help us develop our planning. But again, as lead on ESF 8, Public Health and Medical Services, is where I'm going to focus today, but requires all of our state partners in bringing the things to the arena when we want to develop our plans. So ESF-8's network of care during state-declared disasters. Matter of fact, my first name is Jimmy, and one of my friends the other day says, Jimbo, how are things going? And I said, well, I'm Jimbola this week. I changed my focus. We're always dealing with disasters, and it's really interesting to see how our network works so well no matter what the disaster. But specified time period, state makes a declaration. Whether there's mass casualties or a catastrophic nature, we have surge plans for suburban events. We have a network of 9 regional unified command members of hospitals, EMS, public health, and homeland security. So in any event that occurs in Louisiana and we activate our ESF-8 partners, we know what's happening on the ground. What we learned in Katrina and subsequent to that is that there are a lot of things that are happening that you don't know if they're real or not. And you really require a network of folks to verify what you're dealing with so that you can react to something that's real. Because many times it's rumors and you're reacting to rumors. So again, I can't stress enough how your structure, your infrastructure, determines how important your response is. Certainly, your preparedness infrastructure with a central core at the state level is how Louisiana does it. Some states don't have it centralized, but certainly ours is centralized. We have 9 regions. And we focus on C5, command, control, communication, coordination, collaboration. If we have an event today where there's a train derailment and that train is carrying toxic liquids, within an hour's time, we know what's on the train, we know what schools are in the area, we know what hospitals are in the area. We are responding at the local level and feeding information up to the state on how to respond to every incident. We have several thousand incidents in the state, not that require our attention, But because we have so much industry and so many events, I tell people in Louisiana, we don't really do drills. We do real-life events. It's why we've gotten so good at it. We mobilize for evacuation. We have communication strategy, of course. And communication is the key to getting people out of harm's way, making sure they don't do things that put themselves in jeopardy. We utilize resources as best we can. We're not a rich state from the standpoint of having a lot of wealth. So we rely on resources from the private and public sector, but more so from the private sector. And, of course, scaling your response. We've gone from where we had a horrible hurricane to where we had a tropical storm. Changes the response into whether you're opening shelters, moving people out of hospitals. And so you have to scale your response, and you have to be able to do that timely. This is the way we set up the state, entire nine regions. And for planning purposes, you know, we work from the nine regions. We have it regionalized. We have worked towards having medical directors in every region to make sure that we have leadership at the regional level along with administrators to help the regional response. What we found is that a parish or a county as a counterpart in another state will not have the resources that a region might have. And the region's likely to get the resources there quicker than if they relied on state to get there. So having it regionalized has improved our response. And, of course, in that regionalized response, we have hospitals, EMS, nursing homes, as a group that discuss mass fatalities. And, of course, governmental structure, we have Office of Public Health and the Governor's Office of Homeland Security. Back when we started regionalizing our response in Louisiana, I remember spending hours and days talking to the governor's office to get them to regionalize. I couldn't get them to realize that at the time how important that was. So for a few years, we were regionalized in health, and they came on board, in the past few years, when they realized how effective having somebody at the regional level as opposed to having just people at the state level. And it's really improved our response and our ability to take care of folks. This is what we call the PIT. It's in the Governor's Office of Homeland Security. It's where all the state agencies, and I'm going to share several pictures with you to kind of bring home how we organize. This is where the ESFs work out of, all our partners. So when there's an event, and unified command occurs in this building when the governor comes in and all the cabinet members. And being in the PIT is pretty busy in an event, and it's pretty chaotic, but controlling that chaos and making sense of what's needed is really the job that's at hand. During these events, sometimes the event's not as bad as having to deal with the politics. And I bring this up because I'll share with you, we were moving people out of the Armstrong Airport here in New Orleans, and they had been in a serious situation for about 4 or 5 days, and we were getting them on planes to move them out of state to get help. And Air Force One was coming in, bringing the president, and they shut down the whole response, waiting for the president to come off the plane. Shut down a response of what we were doing to move people. So politics plays into the whole realm of these events. And when they do, it's interesting to try to decide what's right to do to help people, to move things along, and what's right to do to please the politicians coming in. They want to help. They want to do best they can. But they're not so knowledgeable about our plans. So a lot of time our plans get derailed because of the politics, and we spend a lot of time trying to get our plans back on track. And I say this not as a negative. They really want to do the right thing, and we need them, especially when we need funding to do the things we have to do, but they can slow down a process when you're in a disaster. This was downtown New Orleans back right before Katrina, then after you had water and everywhere. So we were taking people on boats, bringing them to dry land, then bringing them by air, and then moving them. We moved 12,000 people out of hospitals. At the time, the media was playing this as poorly planned and poorly handled. I assure you, there is no state in the country that could have handled this any better, not with an unplanned disaster that where you have all these people coming out of harm's way that decided to stay because they had They had been through storm after storm. They didn't see the risk by staying in place. They didn't anticipate that a levee would break and that the water would fall into this low-lying area to where some people would drown and die. They really hadn't anticipated that that could happen because everybody thought the levees would hold because it had done so for 100 years. So when it happened, it caught everyone by surprise, and it took all these resources to get people out of harm's way. Loading on airplanes, moving children. Probably the most touching story I saw personally, I was over at one of the shelters at the time, and I saw a mother and her daughter reconnect. They had gotten lost in the evacuation, and the feeling of them being so ecstatic about finding each other. We spent a lot of time after Katrina trying to get families back together, trying to find out who had passed away and who was still alive. And it was very difficult because they were moving from shelter to shelter in several states, and we were trying to find people, and every time you called back, they had moved. And so, and then when we tried to identify the bodies, which you couldn't identify because they had been in water, they had drowned, and it wasn't identifiable, you really had to start matching DNA of the individual with their family. That's much more difficult than matching DNA of a person with his own DNA. You're trying to match family DNA, and that took weeks and months to get done. And I'll never forget what that was like because it was so complicated and families didn't know where their family members were. This was showing some of the debris. There was a lot of above-ground tombs that got moved, crypts, that we had to, even those people that had died from before, we had to find where they were buried from and get those crypts back to where they were before as we responded to the event after the storm. So to give you an idea of different case studies, H-72, which is 72 hours before that tropical storm wind hits the coast, we start discussing how we're going to evacuate multiple hospitals. And if you can imagine, we got about a 38-hour window. So we have a very short window to get planes here, patients out of a hospital, on a plane, going to a hospital somewhere else. When the coastline of Louisiana evacuates, that means that most of the hospitals, the large hospitals, are in that area. They're having to get out and get out of harm's way. They cannot be absorbed in North Louisiana, which is very rural. So many of these folks are brought onto a plane and brought to a hospital out of state, and that requires using a national disaster medical system, which is working with the federal government to move them because we're absorbing the evacuees in the rest of the state, and of those evacuees, they're going to need medical care. So just being able to handle the people that are evacuating without handling the hospital evacuees is quite a challenge. This is the complexity of working with the federal government to move patients. And I share this with you not to get you to memorize it or be ready for a test, but to show you how many partners there are. We deal with Department of Defense. We deal with HHS. We deal with the local partners. And in this system requires getting a patient matched up with what hospital they're going to. So you have a very sick patient, because if they weren't that sick in a hospital, they were discharged. So the only ones you're going to be moving are the ones that are very sick, and they're going to be moved on a plane, and they're going to be moved to another state. And so it's a very complex process. It's a different language when you deal with the Department of Defense and those folks, so you have to learn their language on what are these different entities and what is their function. As you do this, you're getting them a ticket on the plane to go somewhere and making sure that you're not losing life. So this is make sure that we do this before the storm occurs, which is what happened in Gustav. 3 years after Katrina, Gustav showed up, and we evacuated about 1,500 hospital patients, 1,000 of them within the state, another 500 of them by this process to other states. And we had the largest pre-event evacuation as a result of the experiences we had in Katrina. Gustav was our test run of all the plans we put in place to address Katrina. Whether at hospital level, you get them on the ambulance, get them to the airport, get them on the plane, they're brought to another hospital level in another state. At that AMP, at that aeromedical marshaling point in another state, there's got to be an ambulance pick them up there and bring them to the hospital in the other state. Very complex movement of very sick people, and you're trying not to lose lives as you do this process. We spent a lot of time with hospitals making sure that they were built up their infrastructure, made sure their generators are above sea level so that they don't lose generator power during an event so that they can stay in place. And in Gustav, one of the large hospitals here, about 600 beds, it's like a fortress. They had their generator up, they're ready to stay in place. And the prediction was a 30-foot to 40-foot wall of water surge coming at them. So the day before the storm, they're saying, get us out of here. And we did. It wasn't easy because you had to move all these patients by this process. We do a lot of drills. Like I said, a lot of them are real life, but we also drill with the Department of Defense, with the National Guard, with the military, so that when an event occurs, we can be ready to move patients. Second case study, I'm not going to spend much time on because Dr. Holcomb's going to follow and tell you about our large shelter in Louisiana, but it's really about those folks that have to get out of their homes and get somewhere else and trying to figure out how to put them in shelters. And it's quite a challenge when we had in Gustav about almost 2 million people that was moving from one side of the state and to the northern part of the state and also to other states as well. It takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of planning to take care of shelterees. Dr. Hogan will spend more time. We have medical special needs shelters and federal medical stations to take care of folks. There are a lot of folks at home that are being cared for at home by home health nurses that end up in our shelters because they really can't get to somewhere else where they can be cared for. So we set up these special needs shelters for folks that can't stay in a general shelter. When we first started with this back in 1996, public health was called upon to open up the shelters. And I walked into the governor's office at the time, and they said, we need you to open up special needs shelters. And I said, well, what is that? You know, we used to have Red Cross shelters is what everybody had, and there wasn't a medical special needs shelter. He said, well, that's a shelter where we're going to put people that are too sick for the Red Cross to take care of. Red Cross doesn't have as many medical volunteers anymore, so we need you to stand up with your nurses. I said, my public health nurses? Yes. So my public health nurses who do prevention and immunizations are going to take care of people with PEG tubes and trachs? Yes. A nurse is a nurse is what I was told. I said, well, it doesn't quite work that way. So we opened our first medical special needs shelter at the time, and I walked in, and I'm a pediatrician, and there were elderly patients all over on mattresses on the floor, and they were coming to get me, please come see this gentleman. He just fell and hit his head. Come see this person. She just hurt her hip. And I said, I'm a pediatrician. I guess I'll have to handle it like any other physician. So I guess a public health nurse is a nurse and a doctor is a doctor. That's what we were up against. And to this day, we still staff it with the assistance of a lot of medical professionals, but a lot of public health is the impetus and the lead for getting these things open and making sure that people can get, we can take care of folks. We help coordinate and we help get the people with the proper credentials to help us. This is just a Region 2 shelter stats to show you that we took information, and many of the people that we have in these shelters are really like a large emergency room. I mean, it's truly, they have three and a half, the mean of the number of medical conditions, about 3.5 per patient. Sometimes the caregiver that comes with the patient has as many medical conditions as the patient. So we sometimes have the medical caregiver is as sick as the person that they're there to take care of when they come with them. I wanted to share this with you because I'm sure there's not that many people that have had to deal with this. We were evacuating folks off the coast. And let me go back here. At the time, LSU game was on, and I said, this is an area where we keep our folks. So I said, how are we going to get the medical folks in there, and how are we going to get the patients in the area? And they said, well, let's move the game up. So they moved the game up to the morning, early in the morning, And by afternoon, we were moving patients. So here's some patients being flown in by helicopter while the game was going on. So, again, politics and priorities. You have to be flexible in public health to be able to help people because you're not always given what you need. We certainly didn't need to have the game at a time when we were trying to shelter people. So imagine 90,000 people coming to a game at the same time you're trying to get a million people off the coast. That's what was happening. Not really easy to deal with at the time. Of course, this is what it looks like in our shelters. This is some of the things we have to get ready. Oxygen is in high demand when you have an event. People that depend on oxygen and people that are decompensating. So we have certainly done a lot of the resourcing. I'll let Dr. Holcomb go into his large shelter in a little bit. Many of you probably haven't seen one of these. This is a special outfitted ambulance for a bariatric patient. That means a patient over 250, 300 pounds. We have a lot of those patients that we got to move out of their homes, and we have to have special units to move them because they can't stay in their home where they can get flooded. And we've had some 500, 600-pound people. And if you've eaten in New Orleans, you know why. We have great food, but it's just not healthy for you. So we have had to adjust the way we move people as a result of these events. These were some of the top 10 conditions for long-term sheltering, which we unfortunately had the experience of having to shelter people for months. And hypertension, cardiovascular, diabetes, psychiatric, of course, pre-existing psychiatric conditions, rash, asthma, flu-like. These are all things that can get worse when you're evacuating. In Louisiana, we've had several hurricane seasons now where we've renamed them, because our plan changes. When we had the flu, H1N1, we had plans for her flu. This year, when we were planning for the hurricane, we had plans for her Ebola. You have to be prepared for what's going on at the time in case you get a double whammy. Fortunately, we have it. The double whammies have been two hurricanes back-to-back and not two events such as a disease and an evacuation. Transportation is a huge issue when you're moving people who can't move themselves. So a lot of people self-evacuate, and they take care of themselves. The folks that can't, we have to activate buses and ambulances around H-102. That means that storm's out in the Gulf, might even be out in the Atlantic, and you're starting to, do I need to order these or not? Are they going to get here in time? Am I going to get them here so I can move people? So we start very early moving people out of harm's way before we even know if the storm's going to be a direct hit or not. It takes all kind of vehicles to move people. High water vehicles, such as we see with the National Guard. We have a contract for 700 coast buses that we activate. If you activate it before you have a federal declaration and the storm doesn't come here, the state ends up eating it. So we end up having to pay for it. So we have to balance ordering them early enough, but not ordering so early that the storm turns, then we have an event that we don't get help to pay for. The convoys are tracked so that we can track where folks are being moved, and we work with ESF1 to make this happen. Then we also work with ambulances and Office of Public Health to anywhere from 500 to 600 ambulances that we're moving people out of their homes, to special needs shelters, to hospitals, and so it's a huge, massive movement. It takes a lot of planning and a lot of tracking. I remember distinctly Gustav walking into UCG telling the governor we had X amount of ambulances that morning, and then the afternoon getting there, and there were two less, and he wanted to know what happened to the two ambulances. His memory is so photographic in numbers he focuses on that you have to track these and know exactly how many you have so when you're resourcing it, you know how many people you can take care of. There's detailed plans of where we have movement of ambulances and also movement of folks. And to show you what we did in Gustav with the help of the Nursing Home Association, who's part of our ESF 8, they moved 90 94 nursing homes with about 8,000 people. Now, nursing homes are folks that are usually bedridden for the most part, elderly, very vulnerable. And we managed to move that many folks to other areas away from the coast without any losing any of their lives, which is pretty phenomenal. We also moved a number of hospitals, as I was talking about. And, of course, when you compare the numbers for our surge ambulances, looking at 464 federal ambulances, 88 state ambulances, and 94 EMAC ambulances, so we had 646 ambulances for our surge units. In comparison, in Sandy, they moved five hospitals, and they moved about 1,400 patients. So the numbers were comparable, but the number of hospitals were very different. Search and rescue, another part of our planning. So after storm in Katrina, we did a lot of search and rescue. We don't ever want to do that again. So now we try to get them out before the storm, and search and rescue after storm hopefully will be less numbers. Requires higher water vehicles so that you can get through water. Requires a lot of folks and boats, and this is practicing with a fleet that we did so we can move patients on water. Then you got plans for the animals, because some of the animals get stranded. So the Department of Agriculture is working on plans for the animals. We also have a pet plan to move pets, because many people won't move unless they can bring their pets with them. Mass fatality planning. You wouldn't think that this would be in large numbers, but it's after Katrina, we had to reinter those people that had been buried before close to 1,000. So it's a huge event. This is one that occurred recently along the river where we had inundation, and all these tombs were alongside the road, stopped by the levee. And we had to find out where these bodies were once buried and get them back to their resting grounds. We worked with folks. This is a cemetery where you can see some of the crypts are empty. You can see the devastation of some of these tombs and the caskets. Some of them have to be put in a new casket. Why ESF 8? Probably because we're the ones that helped figure this out, along with the coroners of the state, how to get this done. Truly, in ESFA, we're trying to keep people alive. This is dealing with folks that have been buried. Quite an education. Takes large equipment to help move these things because they're very heavy. They're out of concrete. As you can see, you got to get around electrical wires. It's quite sophisticated. We also had a group out of LSU that would come in and help identify remains, because sometimes we find just the remains and didn't know who they were, so they'd come, and sometimes you'd find things with the remains that would help identify them. Sometimes it was bones, sometimes it was something somebody was buried with. Somebody remembered their family member had a certain ring or had a certain can of beer or something, whatever, in their coffin, and that's how we identified them. We use a lot of labor to do this. We also use prisoner labor to help us with this. So in talking about all this, and I know it's a lot of information, a little bit of time, and certainly looking forward to questions, but we've lived through the largest post-storm evacuation in Katrina. Then we lived through the largest pre-storm evacuation in Gustav. And then, a couple years later, we had the largest oil spill, where we had to deal with oil spill in our Gulf waters affecting our seafood industry. So imagine all these industries, restaurants, seafood, petroleum industry that got devastated by these events, has to shut down, having to start up again, and then have one event after another every few years that keeps slowing you down. So you're still seeing New Orleans 9 years later, they're still rebuilding after Katrina. I can tell you this, in Tropical Storm Isaac a couple years ago, the water came in and came into areas now that we have our a lot of buildup of our levees. We now have new areas that get inundated in the state, because what we've done is steer the water away from New Orleans, and now we have areas of the state that are now flooding that didn't flood before. So you learn that when you mess with Mother Nature and you try to make things work better. Sometimes you fix one thing, but it disrupts something else. And we're learning that when we plan to move somebody out of New Orleans, it doesn't always work that way, because in Gustav, Baton Rouge got hit very hard, and Baton Rouge had taken the brunt of the movement, and Baton Rouge hospitals then had to worry about closing and shutting down. They were moving people back to New Orleans because Baton Rouge was so damaged after Gustav. So we've learned that got to be flexible. The plan has got to roll with what's happening, and you have to save lives. And so it's required a change in culture, preparedness culture, a change in public health professionals from being, working at a health unit 8 to 4:30 to being available 24/7. And I wish I could tell you that that makes public health folks and everybody that does this more valuable, and people are going to say, we need more of them. We need to hire more of them. But exactly the opposite has happened. We have actually laid off more state workers since all these events. We used to have in the Department of Health and Hospitals in Louisiana, which is central throughout the state, about 13,000 employees. We now have around 6,000. We've gone to less than half. And so you depend on your relationships with the private sector. Private sector has 80-85% of assets. Government doesn't. The expectation on government is we're going to be there and we're going to save people. But without our private partners, we're not going to do it. So we have had to build relationships with our private partners to be able to do all this. So we're ranked third in the country for disaster preparedness. And I'm really proud of that, because people would say, if you don't have the funds for this, then how are you going to be this successful? And I can tell you what it is. It's a lot of folks that have worked with me and all the folks in Louisiana, that we've had so many events that when we pull together, we can make a lot happen for very little. Now, we depend on a lot of federal resources, but those would come anyway. Using them and knowing how to save lives has become what we spend a lot of our time doing. I mean, we do a lot of preventive medicine, a lot of immunizations, but we spend a lot of time on emergency preparedness. So an application, we might use the science, the state plan, the protocols, and the policy, all as guidelines. But you got to be flexible to address multiple expectations, differing political pressures, available assets, and unpredictable behaviors in a changing threat environment. Rita was a storm that came 2 weeks after Katrina. It was a larger storm. It was more devastating than Katrina from the standpoint of how big it was, how much water came in. But the assets were here from Katrina. We didn't lose anybody in Rita because we had the assets that had were here because of Katrina. So if you have all the assets you need and you have the folks willing to do the work, you can save a lot of lives. So I hope other states can learn from these experiences so that we don't have to have another Katrina where we lose 1,400, 1,500 people. That's the part that hurts the most, is that we lost folks because we didn't have a plan that got them out of harm's way. And that's what all of this has been about, is making sure that that doesn't happen again. And certainly, I'm glad to share it with y'all, and I'm going to let Dr. Holcomb present his mega shelter, and then we'll probably have questions after that. But thank you for being here today.